Support for this KQED podcast comes from Walmart Labs, based in Silicon Valley. Powered by its own open source technology, Walmart Labs engineers code in an agile DevOps environment. Learn more about engineering and big data positions at walmartlabs.com.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Talking about things like race, gender, sexuality, or controversial topics is hard enough, and these days it can be even harder on a college campus. More universities are taking action against those small, unexpected offenses known as microaggressions, and more instructors are alerting their students to potentially upsetting course content called trigger warnings. But how much is too much? At what point does sensitivity at school become coddling on campus? We'll hear from students and professors and take your calls next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. Good morning. I'm Joshua Johnson of KQED News, sitting in for Michael Krasny. Jerry Seinfeld, Chris Rock, and Bill Maher are all veteran stand-up comedians with decades of experience and many, many fans. But they have all struggled to handle the crowds on college campuses. All three men have lamented how, in their views, college students are overly sensitive to the material, be it a comedy routine or a commencement speech, and therefore make terrible audiences. This is one example of what some argue is a wrong-headed approach to a real problem: how to preserve the dignity of young people who do not deserve to be slighted, insulted, victimized, or discounted. Some students say thoughtless statements regarding race, gender, or contentious topics make it harder for them to thrive in class, sometimes even reopening old traumatic wounds. So, what should colleges and universities do? If you're the kind of person who treads oh so lightly around taboo topics, or the type who wishes we could stop being so touchy all the time, then this hour of Forum is for you, especially if you have a kid in college, or if you are one. Joining us to discuss it is Professor Jonathan Haidt from New York University's Stern School of Business. He recently expressed his concerns about this more sensitive approach in an article in The Atlantic magazine. Professor Haidt, welcome to Forum.
Thank you, Jeff.
Also with us on the line is Professor Darold Wing Su from Columbia University's Teachers College. His latest book is called Race Talk and the Conspiracy of Silence: Understanding and Facilitating Difficult Dialogues on Race. Professor Su, welcome.
Thank you.
Professor Su, let me start with you. Before we get into this conversation, we should define two terms that will be coming up a lot in this hour. We've used them in previous Forum shows before, but they bear repeating: microaggressions and trigger warnings. Let's take these one at a time. First of all, Professor Su, what is a microaggression?
Well, microaggressions are the everyday slights and dignities, insults, invalidations that marginalized group members experience in their day-to-day interactions with well-intentioned individuals who oftentimes are unaware that they have delivered a microaggression. And this is where it becomes very difficult to deal with in terms of getting people aware of what is happening in the communication and interpersonal interaction.
Can you give us some examples of microaggressions?
A number of them. Let me give you some personal examples that I've experienced. One of them is that when I give a presentation, usually to an audience, I will be complimented by a listener for speaking good English. I generally respond by saying, "Thank you, I hope so, I was born here." Now, that seems a very insignificant slight that may be occurring, because the person delivering it means that it's a compliment, but they are unaware that the communication they are sending to me is that I am a perpetual alien in my own country. And that is what is being communicated in what I call a metacommunication.
Let me back up for one second. Just to clarify the image, how do you define your nationality?
I'm Chinese American.
Got it. So they look, okay, that makes more sense. So they look at you and presume that because you appear to be of Asian descent, obviously, that
yes.
your English language skill is somehow a leap beyond, that you had to basically acquire this language, and boy, isn't that an accomplishment.
Well, actually, more than that, it's that I am not a true American because of my visible racial ethnic identity or image.
Gotcha. Gotcha. All right, let's talk about trigger warnings. What is a trigger warning?
Well, you know, I'm not sure how you are using trigger warnings.
I guess I'm thinking about the things that college professors have said in class when there's sensitive material. Have you had to deal with that at all?
You know, many times. I mean, in fact, we've done studies on how professors inadvertently deliver microaggressions without really realizing it. One example that we constantly get from African-American students is that when they make a contribution in class, the professor compliments them for being so intelligent, articulate, and insightful. And again, this is the dilemma. It appears to be a compliment, but the communication striking that African-American student is that the professor is actually surprised that a black student can be so intelligent and articulate. By the way, this is something that happens with our president, Barack Obama, as well.
Jonathan Haidt, I want to get to you in just 1 second in terms of trigger warnings, but I do want to welcome one more person to the conversation for the hour. Professor Ho-May King teaches art history and film studies at Bryn Mawr College. Professor King, glad to have you with us.
Hi, thank you.
I'll get to you in just a minute, Professor King, but Jonathan Haidt, let me put that question to you as well. What have you noticed on college campuses as it relates to these trigger warnings?
Well, so college students have always been politically active. They've always been striving for justice. When I was in college in the 80s, we were all focused on apartheid in South Africa. But I think what's changed is the heightened sensitivity in the last 5 or so years, and in part this is because of Professor Su's groundbreaking article where he introduced the term microaggressions. But when the focus of moral concern turns on how we talk to each other and treat each other, then we get some really unfortunate consequences. So I agree with Professor Su that there's a problem in communication and that it's important that students tell each other and professors how to talk. But I think the problem is with the label, with calling it an aggression. Rather than, as Professor Su said, they're often well-intentioned. If they were called unintentional slights, it would be much, much better. My concern is that it's college campuses have become such hotbeds of mutual recrimination and anger that the learning environment not only has become unconducive to learning, but it actually is likely to be damaging the students' mental health.
So I do want to get more into that idea of the damage that it may cause. Your article in The Atlantic talked a bit, if memory serves, about the impact of this on instructors, that they have to kind of tiptoe through or maybe even around certain topics just in case they might offend someone. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. So this is what many instructors are saying, many professors. Now, it has not hit all schools. It tends to happen especially at schools that lean heavily to the left. So it's especially in the UC schools. I've seen a bit of it at NYU. It's in the Northeast a lot. The idea that when students encounter something that they now call an aggression or a microaggression, they don't go talk to the professor necessarily. The first email is to the dean or to some administrator because something must be done. An adult must do something to punish this person who has aggressed.
Ho-May King, I imagine that you've encountered this in your classrooms also, partly because your instruction involves film, and there are a number of movies that are great classics, but that have some pretty strong material.
Absolutely. And I'll just back up a minute and say that I actually think that educating people about microaggressions versus debating whether to implement a policy of requiring trigger warnings, written trigger warnings on syllabi, to me are two very separate issues, although they appear to arise out of a similar kind of campus climate. A microaggression is usually, in my experience, an interpersonal kind of incident between a student and a fellow student or between a professor and a student. Whereas the call for a trigger warning is really about instituting a kind of policy that would make a kind of contract with the students where the syllabus will indicate in writing whenever any material on a film or even a written text could be traumatizing or re-trigger a kind of post-traumatic stress reaction in a student.
Now, I wonder about the subject matter that you teach, Professor King, because you deal with film, and in some ways, we already have some warnings like this. They're called movie ratings. I mean, now, movie ratings give you even more information. They used to just say G, PG, PG-13, RX, NC-17. Now it's, this film is rated PG-13 for strong language, graphic situations, gory violence, you know, whatever it is. What's the big deal about doing this in a classroom? Don't we already warn people about content?
Well, first of all, I would say the MPAA rating system has a history. It came out of the Hays Code and the Production Code, which was a kind of self-imposed system of censorship
right.
that the film industry created in the 30s. And that's really about a consumer product that is for entertainment that people buy or opt into by choice. And in a way, I think that the call for trigger warnings is related to the kind of commodification of higher education as a product. And, you know, for me personally, I'm against that trend, but it makes sense logically that if students are in a way told that their education is a consumer product, that they're going to treat the content that way and expect as a consumer would to be pleased by the product and not have it cause discomfort.
So no icky feelings when we're talking about tough movies. It just needs to be easy, palatable, get me in the class, get me out with an A.
Exactly. But again, I would not blame the students necessarily for this this trend. I think it has to do with a kind of overall commodification of higher education.
We're discussing cultural sensitivity on college campuses today with NYU professor Jonathan Haidt, Columbia professor Daryl Wing Su, and Bryn Mawr professor Ho-May King. And we also need to hear from you, too. If you're a student, what's it like at your college right now? Are people mindful of these kinds of things? Do they care? Is it a problem? Is everything all right? If you're the parent of a college kid, how do you feel about the cultural climate your child is studying in? And if you teach in higher education, how free do you feel to speak your mind, to be understood, maybe even to catch problems before they arise? We welcome your questions, your thoughts, your horror stories, if you have any, or stories of maybe how these exchanges went well. We'd like you in the conversation. Call us. The number is 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also post your comments online. Go to kqed.org/forum. Let's hear now from a local student who's been dealing with this issue on campus. Joining us now is Elena Marchetti Bowick. She is a rising junior at Stanford. Elena, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you for making time for us. Now, a few months ago, you wrote an opinion piece in the campus newspaper, the Stanford Daily, questioning how committed the university community really is to racial justice and racial equity. What prompted that?
So there was a protest on campus during our admit weekend, which is essentially a weekend where newly admitted students come to sort of tour the campus and decide whether or not they want to come here. And during admit weekend, there was a protest by some activists on campus about sort of the way the university has been handling racial issues, specifically some allegations, which were actually mentioned in the New York Times, by an undergrad woman running for student senate, that one of the organizations on campus was questioning her Jewish identity and, you know, expressing some anti-Semitism towards her. And essentially, the protest was about the administration's reaction to this issue. And a lot of students of color, I think, felt that the administration wasn't really prioritizing their needs and wasn't really caring about the, you know, racism that they experience on campus.
So you wrote this because you didn't feel the university was being vocal enough or the university community was not taking a definitive enough stance?
I wrote this mostly because of the campus reaction to these protests. A lot of students were very upset that these activists chose to sort of protest during Admit Weekend, and I thought that was a little bit unjustified. I think that, you know, we should be supporting people who are fighting for racial justice, and I think that a lot of students, you know, sort of get annoyed by what they call too much activism, and I think instead we should, you know, we should understand that people of color and, you know, other marginalized communities experience a lot of oppression on college campuses and, you know, elsewhere.
It seems like some of that annoyance and some of that kind of being saturated with this conversation played out in a Facebook group called Stanford Macro Aggressions, kind of a tongue-in-cheek look at some of the cultural sensitivity. I imagine that you were not pleased with that either.
No, I was not.
What were some of the things that were, if you can, if nothing was too terribly offensive to say on the radio, give me an example of the kinds of the tone and the content that you saw in that group.
So the group is a satirical group based off, you know, it's a play on microaggressions. And it essentially what it does is usually post pictures of, you know, something around campus, such as there was one picture of three vases, two were white and one was black, and it said, look at the white supremacy on campus, you know, this is such hegemony because, you know, we have two white vases and one black vase.
This is like a picture of vases that were around campus?
Yeah, you know, some random lobby or something. And so a lot of posts like these, you know, essentially making fun of people who, you know, are offended by, you know, what are legitimate problems on campuses and, you know, outside of campus. And I think, you know, a lot of marginalized communities, people of color, you know, women, people who identify as queer, you know, they do experience significant oppression on campus. And it does, you know, impede their mental health. It does impede their ability to learn. And it is, you know, it's not trivial. And so I think essentially making fun of this is not, it's not quite understanding the negative effects that these issues have.
Right. I hear you on that. I can also imagine some people hearing what you just said and thinking that you're just being too touchy, that college has to be a place where we can speak our mind and deal with uncomfortable topics and be offended, because the world can be a very offensive place. And if university is supposed to do anything for you, it's to prepare you for the real world. And maybe you just need to not be quite so touchy. How would you respond to that?
So I absolutely agree that, you know, in general, people, you know, need to learn how to be able to be offended by something. But I think the issue is that a lot of these, you know, microaggressions, they're not just a matter of, you know, somebody coming up to you and saying, oh, your shirt is ugly, because, you know, they have a historical context. You know, if somebody comes up to you and you're a person of color and they say, wow, you sound so smart, not like most black people, you know, that is not the same as just a random, you know, offensive comment based on anything. You know, that comes from a context of, you know, black people being told that they are not as smart as white people.
Well, but that's what, hold on, let me stop you there. And I take your point, but I want to put that to Professor Daryl Wing Su from Columbia. If somebody walked up to me and said, oh, Josh, you're so smart, not like most black people, that would be a thing. Let's just put it like that. It wouldn't end well. But what you're talking about, Professor Su, is much more subtle than that. I mean, what Elena just suggested sounds like overt racism. Wow, you're smart, not like most black people. What you're suggesting, Professor Su, is that layer just kind of below that, where maybe they're not even aware of the point of view, or maybe they just don't, emotionally, they know that that view is bad, but they kind of can't help saying it. Are these two different things?
Well, they are on different ends of the continuum. Microaggressions can be intentional or unintentional. They can be subtle or overt. But what I think that is getting compounded and confused here is the relationship of when people say that today's students of color are overly sensitive, they don't realize the harm that is being, placed upon students of color. And this is not simply speculation. We have conducted over, what is it, a period of 10 years, what we call the harmful impact controversy. Because when you look at microaggressions on the surface, they appear trivial, harmless, insignificant. Oh, yeah, you were offended. Let's talk about that. The studies on microaggressions really indicate that they are constant, continual, cumulative, and that they create double binds for individuals. And when we looked at the outcome, the results and impact of microaggressions, we found that they assail the mental health of the recipients. They create a hostile and invalidating campus climate. They perpetuate stereotype threat, create health problems in individuals, and they actually impact work productivity in the workplace and the ability to learn in an educational setting. And it's really quite, you know, important for us to realize that these are not harmless, insignificant, trivial types of behaviors or non-verbal or verbal behaviors being implemented by well-intentioned individual. In fact, Maya Angelou talks about this. She says that it is not the overt racist or the overt hate crimes that are most damaging to people of color, but what she calls the everyday slights and dignities that can come from either well-intentioned individuals or individuals that are not so, she calls it she never used the term microaggressions, but she described death by a thousand cuts.
So let me put that to Professor Jonathan Haidt, and briefly, we're coming up on a break in just a few seconds, but Professor Haidt, it sounds like there is a case to be made for the damage to this, but I imagine that your concern is not validating the problem, it's how we deal with what we consider a solution.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. Colleges are getting more diverse, language has to change. It's important, especially now that finally gay people are getting full rights, so language has to change. The question is, what's the best way to do it? And if people would read Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People, they would learn, start with a smile, don't accuse people of things, acknowledge their basic decency. I mean, if you really wanted to change language, you would go about it a certain way. But if what you want to do is basically express your moral views and your political views, you would go about it in a much more aggressive way.
Well, we're going to get deeper into that when we come back from the other side of the break. I definitely want to hear more from our callers about their experiences. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation on cultural sensitivity at college campuses with NYU Professor Jonathan Haidt, Columbia Professor Daryl Wing Su, Bryn Mawr Professor Homei King, and thanks to Stanford student Elena Marchetti Bowick for spending part of this hour with us. Elena, glad to have had you with us. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
I'm Joshua Johnson. Glad to be with you. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio. I'm Joshua Johnson, sitting in for Michael Krasny. We're continuing our conversation on cultural sensitivity at college campuses with NYU Professor Jonathan Haidt, Columbia Professor Daryl Wing Su, and Bryn Mawr Professor Homei King. And we need to hear from you, so call us. The number is 866-733-6786. Email us. The address is forum@kqed.org. You can also find us on Facebook or tweet us. We're at KQED Forum. Let me get to a few of your online comments. Sean wrote us on our website, "Triggers are a real thing. However, trigger warnings are more and more getting used to protect oneself from opposing opinions than actual triggers. The whole point of college is to learn what you don't know and unlearn what you know wrong. That means having your opinions and perceived facts challenged. Unfortunately, many college students have found a way to ensure that never happens. Beth wrote us on Facebook, "Anyone can see how troubling it is that someone would pay tens of thousands of dollars a year for a university education where one would then demand political correctness rather than what the word education actually means, which is being exposed to all ideas and in turn learning critical thinking skills." Professor Homei King, is that what this feels like? A little bit too much political correctness that affects the way you teach?
Well, you know, I went to college in the 90s, so I was part of the, I guess you would call it the politically correct generation. And, you know, I really am sympathetic to the activism that I see from students around issues of sexual violence, racial discrimination, and so on. It's quite heartening for me in a way to see that uprise on campus. On the other hand, going about it through a policy of trying to protect a kind of fictional, very vulnerable fellow student who could potentially be traumatized by any content on a syllabus, which I think at its most good faith, well-intentioned, that's what these policies are really about, not just trying to opt out of difficult or opposing materials. That, even at its most well-intentioned, is potentially harmful.
Jonathan Haidt, I wonder where you draw the line, where you find that line is between being helpful and just being overly sensitive. I mean, is there a way, in your view, to alert students, to alert faculty to these kinds of touchy issues in a way that clears people's minds and lets them actually focus on the material without going, as you might see it, overboard? What would a better way forward look like?
Well, I think we have to step back and see what effect it has. Professor King mentioned something about it suggests a contract with the student. That's where it really gets dangerous. I was talking with a professor who said when he shows images of lynchings in the South, yeah, he's going to warn people, and I totally agree with that. I mean, that's horrible, horrible to see. But in a politicized climate where trigger warnings come to be used for anything the left doesn't like, including classism, privilege, the idea that professors will warn students and have a contract with them that don't worry, nothing upsetting will come unless there's a warning. That's basically the way Sean put it, the guy who wrote in online. And this creates expectations that when students go through life, I mean, what's going to happen when they leave college? They've been protected by adults their whole childhood, and in college the protections should be pulled back. But instead the protections, the bubble wrap, gets even thicker. And when they go out into the workplace, boy, are they going to have trouble. Boy, are they going to end up in lawsuits the rest of their lives.
Let's get in on the phones now. 866-733-6786, beginning with Hari in Santa Cruz. Hari, good morning.
Hi. I'm a college student at UC Santa Cruz. It's a pretty liberal campus, and we have protests and activism all the time. And there is huge backlash, especially from the white male demographic, because they don't like it. And what concerned me was one of your panelists said that these offenses that are known as microaggressions should be reduced to being called innocent slights. That's actually hurtful to the minority community a lot, because it allows people who make these mistakes constantly to not care as much about them when in reality they are microaggressions. Now, I fully agree that the oversensitivity when it affects education is bad, but to reduce microaggressions to innocent slights is even worse, because there is a problem with people not realizing how offensive they could be or not realizing their privilege in the community.
Hey, Hari, I think that was Professor Haidt who made that point about unintentional slights. And, Professor, I'm going to give you a chance to respond in just a second. But, Hari, I just wanted to drill down a little bit deeper on something you said about the way that you've noticed that white male students tend to react badly to these kinds of protests or react negatively. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I'm Indian American, and I do consider myself privileged to an extent. But I am around a lot of other minorities who constantly feel oppressed through these microaggressions. But my friends, who happen to be white and male, they've never really been in the situation where they've felt oppressed or they've felt threatened before. And because they don't see it happening, they think all these steps and all these advances towards social progress are unnecessary, unneeded, and just annoying.
Hmm. All right. Well, Hari, I appreciate you calling in. Thanks for talking to us. Professor Haidt, what do you make of Hari's comment?
Oh, to the extent that people are saying things that are overtly racist, and that especially given the anonymity of social media, I don't just mean overtly. Some of the examples that Professor Hsu gave, we would all agree, are racist or insulting. But my concern is that we've crossed a line where the definition is not what a person would think this means or what was the intention. The definition is if someone feels offended, then an offense has taken place. And this is what is called in cognitive therapy emotional reasoning. When we start telling people, if you feel bad, then someone has harmed you, someone has been aggressive, someone needs to be punished. And this is what turns campuses into such hotbeds of incivility and constant argument. So I think one of the dynamics that Hari might have been referring to is, yeah, the white males often are rather opposed to all of these movements, in part because they're constantly told, you're the villain, you're a racist, you're the problem, you're the oppressor. And so it should not be surprising that when you approach people by saying, we have a problem, and it's you, you're a racist, you're the oppressor, well, yeah, they don't say, oh, gosh, you're right. Again, it's straight out of Dale Carnegie. If people wanted to change norms on campus, they should try to actually change them, not to just demonize people and attack them and call them aggressors.
Let's continue on the phones now with Karen in Oakland. Karen, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind, Karen?
Oh, wow. I think I'm a walking historical figure here. I was raised in Berkeley, and I helped form the Afro-American Association with Don Warden years ago, and I finally became an educator. For 42 years, I was an educator. And I think I had slights from the English. I taught English and critical thinking, okay? And so I came through the Afro-American culture in Berkeley, which was very, you know, high level. And I taught critical thinking in the classroom. And one of my students, I don't know how many years ago, it was, I'm pretty sure it was Oriental student.
An Asian student.
Went to the dean about my aggressive teaching methods, and I did dichotomies. If you said one thing, I asked you the other, you know, so that you can think on both sides of the issue. And the dean wouldn't let me know what the student said or anything, but just ranted and raved. And here I had been teaching much, much longer than she was a dean, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And, wow, I'll never forget that. It's only one experience in my lifetime, but I'll never forget it. It was, like, humiliating.
You know, Karen, I hate to do this to you, but I have to point you out as an example. The fact that as you were relating the story, you referred to the student as Oriental instead of Asian might be felt as an offense to some people who heard it. I mean, I was always taught, and this is a very oversimplistic way of saying it, but I was always taught that rugs are Oriental and people are Asian as a simple mnemonic when I was a little kid to remind me not to say that. And just the fact that you said that, I could feel myself go, ooh, Karen, I'm going to have to correct you as soon as you say that. I mean, it kind of occurs to me that it can happen just that quickly from someone who clearly you did not mean any offense.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Karen, I appreciate
it. I'm cold on the carpet. And I'm multi-ethnic. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous.
I
think it's too much sensitivity.
It's not easy. It's not easy to work through. Karen, I appreciate you calling. Thanks very much for talking to us. Eileen wrote to us on Facebook, this conversation relates to the last hour of Forum about integration in schooling. If students' first encounter with historically oppressed black and brown folks is in college, and they have come to believe that their privileged worldview is the only one that matters, then they will be shocked when they are called out for their microaggressions. They are clueless about how impoverished their educations have been by a lack of diverse perspectives on the world. Elaine wrote us online, way too much attention is being placed on well-being and not nearly enough on competitiveness, excellence, and rigor. Let's continue on the phones now with Jose in Santa Cruz. Jose, good morning.
Good morning.
Hey, Jose, what's on your mind?
Yes, I'm a Mexican-American, 79 years old, and last year I took an auto class at one of the community colleges here at Silicon Valley. And when I first came in, the instructor kind of challenged me because all the kids were 18 to, say, 35, and here I was a 79. I said, are you in the right class? said, yes, and then he challenged me again, what's your name? Then we noticed my name was in the roster. He said, okay, go ahead and sit down. Anyway, one of the things a lot of people were complaining on him, so like the gentleman that just wrote, I went ahead and wrote a letter to the dean of that department and also a copy, carbon copy to the dean of supervisor or attendance or what have you.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the reasons I think they don't have that sensitive because they're not aware of what they've been doing, just like that recent caller right now. She wasn't aware about the Oriental versus Asian.
Right.
And I suggested in the letter to for the instructor to have a black studies or minority studies so he can learn a little about the other culture.
Were there any times when they said something or did something that you felt specifically insulted by in the classroom?
Not only myself, but various other people. It's like I wrote a letter to the superintendent inciting that part.
Because of their perceptions about you being Mexican-American?
That and various other things throughout the course.
I see.
And the second subject that I want to talk about is that one of the things they were talking about, the instructor, was that during the recession, there was a lot of layoffs and a lot of people were not able to have a job, special middle age management.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him, hey, I'm glad that happened because now other people besides minorities know what it's like to not be able to get a job even if they're qualified because they give it to a white. And if it's a white, it's because they give it to a younger guy.
So you felt that it was kind of a moment where they could feel where you were coming from.
Right.
Gotcha. Hey, Jose.
Anyway, Michael, appreciate it.
Hey, Jose, I appreciate you calling in. Thanks very much for talking to us. Let's continue on the phones with Wyatt in Vallejo. Wyatt, good morning.
Hey, thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Wyatt?
I can't really speak too much about the college course. I've never been to college. I got a high school education, but I grew up in Vallejo. And as far as the stand-up comedy and audiences being too sensitive to it, I think that race is like it's a traumatic thing for people to talk about. And it's something that it's like a defense mechanism. They'd rather laugh about it than have to talk about it in such serious tones all the time.
Yeah.
And I feel like a lot of the outrage that comes from people making racial jokes or even mentioning race in a stand-up comedy comes from people who didn't grow up in a multi-ethnic community. Like for myself, growing up in Vallejo, you know, riding the bus to school, I was maybe one of three or four white kids on the bus. So I don't have the point of view of growing up in a school district that's 70, 80% white. And I think when you're not exposed to different races, you don't know how to treat humor about it, you know?
Right. Yeah, Wyatt, that's a good point. Thank you for calling in on that. Let me put that to Professor Daryl Wing Sue. You know, Wyatt makes a point about comedy, and I'm sure that some people think that they're just kind of being funny, and they don't realize where the line is, but they don't really mean any harm.
I think it goes right back to the issue that people sometimes don't understand nor realize the traumatized experience of being, let's say, a person of color in the United States, that from the moment of birth, you experience, communications that you are a lesser being, that there is something wrong with you. And so any minor, insignificant thing like a joke or a statement can represent the straw that breaks the camel's back. And that is one of the reasons why I think you get people who are most disempowered reacting in such a way to what other people see as trivial, slight, and insignificant. But there is something that I do want to say. You know, I had the same reaction that you did when I heard the term Oriental, but my immediate reaction after that was that we all commit racial blunders. It's how you recover rather than how you cover up, and that this represented, like for the woman who called in, a learning opportunity. The third thing, if I can quickly respond to,
sure,
is the reaction that the person, one of the callers saying that white people seem to get defensive or upset with these particular comments. And we actually have conducted studies in terms of why white folks find it difficult to deal with issues of race when we begin to talk about it. And there are really four layers. I can't go into it, but one of the greatest fears that white folks tend to have about talking about race is the whole issue of implicit bias, that none of us can be born and raised in the United States without inheriting these biases, and to be fearful of committing a behavior or making a statement that is apparently racist is something enough to make people get very defensive about.
So when someone makes a mistake, it just amplifies it. It makes it feel all the more damning.
That's right.
Gotcha. Let's continue on the phones. Ben in Palo Alto. Ben, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
So I am a current college student at a UC campus, and I am involved in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, which is a divisive issue on almost all college campuses nowadays. And I represent a side, and I've gone into many debate with the opposing side, and I feel like the opposing side uses kind of political correctness to undermine what I'm saying. At the same time, I can't, you know, every time I say something, I get chanted at and said, you know, they say abusive things like, I defend Israel and they call me a murderer. But as soon as I talk about, they're uncomfortable with the word terrorism. So I can't use that. And, you know, it's frustrating to me that, you know, I believe in open debate and, you know, that everybody's entitled to say what they want. And, you know, we should have the ability to talk to one another without, you know, having to, you know, watch what we say to an extent. Obviously, you know, there are stuff that is offensive and we shouldn't say that. The only other thing I would add before I end is it's frustrating that a college campus, the administration, would back one side or back something that's divisive or offensive.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, and I don't know what campus you go to, but I was going to ask you what your perception was of how the administration has been responding to all of this.
Well, I go to UC Riverside, and I feel like the administration has made a lot of effort to back both sides, you know, but at the same time, the opposing side of my argument is very active, and there's a lot of things which upset me and hurt my community, but they're entitled to do that, like a die-in by the bell tower, which is the center of our quad. The administration, you know, they can do what they want, but the administration made a mistake, in my opinion, by backing a speaker of the opposing side who was very radical and giving college credit to go to the speaker without giving any viewpoint from the opposing side.
Gotcha. Hey, Ben, I appreciate you calling. Thanks for talking to us. I did want to put that point to Professor Homei King from Bryn Mawr College. I wonder what your perception is of how your school, which is a very high-performing liberal arts college in Pennsylvania, Bryn Mawr, has handled these kinds of things in terms of trying to create a welcoming campus environment without taking sides too much, trying to kind of walk the line and be on exactly the right side of both issues?
Well, let's see. Our Student Governance Association actually voted to approve a trigger warning policy that would require faculty to include written warnings on syllabi for any text or film or content that could broach sensitive issues. And there were a list of kind of suggested or sample warnings, which included sexual violence, gender discrimination, racial discrimination, alcoholism, smoking, you know, all these kinds of things that could be potentially triggering or offensive. The faculty have not implemented that policy. And I have to say that really across the political spectrum from faculty, I'm not seeing a whole lot of interest in implementing this kind of policy really from anyone. But what that suggests to me is really I'm curious about what's behind it, what's motivating it, and what are the students really asking for here? And is it about wanting a sense of being cared for or protected by the institution or by the faculty? Is it something else?
Okay, if I can jump in.
Please.
In trying to understand why trigger warnings emerged so quickly just in the last few years onto college campuses, in the Atlantic article, my co-author Greg Lukianoff and I, our analysis is that the main trend driving it is the changes in childhood that happened beginning in the 1980s. After the crime wave and the faces appearing on milk cartons, parents just began protecting much more, even coddling. Administrators in school always stepped in. If my kids hear somebody call someone else stupid, they all look to the adult. An adult must step in if someone calls someone stupid. So there have been big changes in childhood, and now so the millennial generation has been raised very differently from previous generations. Combined with that is the rapid growth in political polarization. So left and right really hate each other now, much more than they did 20 or 30 years ago. And so if you look at the list that Professor King just gave, what is it that deserves a trigger warning? It's not just violence and disfigured bodies. It's sexism and racism. In other words, the left gets to say that the constructs that we are most concerned about, those are such awful things that we need to put a warning label as though it was radioactive. It's a way of, I think, taking unfair advantage of its dominance on the campus. And that's, I think, what Ben was complaining about, that if we're holding a minority position politically, if you're not in the orthodox position on the left, you will get shouted down and shut up, and people want trigger warnings on you.
We're running out of time for the hour, but I do want to get to a few more comments. Mimi writes us online, "I'm a counseling psychology student at a university in San Francisco where issues of triggers and microaggressions come up often. Interestingly, the only professors who seem to be concerned about the oversensitivity of students at my school are the white baby boomers and Gen Xers, who have the most bias and privilege." Joseph wrote us online, "The concept of microaggressions is one of the worst additions to the public discourse on race that I can think of. It implies that these types of incidents only matter or matter most when it's based on race, ignoring the fact that literally everybody has issues and subjects that cause them the exact same form of discomfort. In addition to being Jewish, I have many personal experiences, beliefs, and lifestyle choices that make me very different from mainstream American culture. On a daily basis, I suffer a thousand of the cuts that Dr. Sue referred to, and I understand that that is one of the costs of living in a diverse community, where not everyone is fully aware of every facet of everyone else's background and character." Let's get in another phone call now from Rich in Santa Rosa. Rich, good morning.
Hey, thank you. Good timing. I couldn't disagree more with the last view that you read. This idea that microaggressions is a bad thing that we've become aware of is not something I agree with. The difference between being offended by somebody because of your views and a microaggression is microaggressions are based on historic inequalities.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, I'm a privileged white male coming from an upper middle class background. I'm offended because somebody said something about a privileged white male from an upper. You know, that's not what it is. It's about tying these things to the deep inequalities that exist. To the if you look at prisons, if you look at school achievement, if you look at these things, there are deep inequalities, and we have to look at these. We have to look at the underdogs in these battles, and we have to recognize that it's not just political correctness; it's moral correctness that we correct all these things. And so, I disagree with this idea that you smile and you make friends, and this is ludicrous. You need to stand up for these things because they create teaching moments. I think someone said that, and I've been in a classroom for the last 2 years at a UC campus in a graduate program in education, and the biggest, and it's a cohort model, the same people, same classes,
right,
for 2 years. And the biggest changes I've seen in my cohort are from these discussions where we really peel back people's ingrained beliefs that are really part of this this greater society that's been developed and perpetuated that that favors some people and not others.
Right. Rich, I appreciate the comment. Thanks very much for calling in. Let me get to one more comment online as we're running out of time for the hour. It's actually perhaps a worthwhile critique of this hour and of something that we previewed for tomorrow's forum. Davey writes, it's interesting that in a show on microaggression, you're running an announcement, a promo, about a future show on men's studies with mock shock that you could get a master's degree in that. While women's studies are accepted, men's studies are a surprise and not taken seriously? Isn't that a microaggression itself? Okay, Davey, fair point. Maybe that is a microaggression. I would put it back on you. I'd be interested to know what you would have preferred that we said, how we would have preferred to phrase it. Drop a comment on the Facebook page. I'd like to see what you would say about how maybe we could have said that differently to not provoke that reaction. Jonathan Haidt, it seems like Davey's comment goes right to the heart of this matter. Where do you think we need to go from here? Very briefly, running out of time in the hour. What do you think we need to do?
I think we need to understand just how difficult it is to have a diverse community. And the worst thing we could do is ramp up everyone's sensitivities and sort of gotcha attitudes towards catching everyone in aggressions.
Mm-hmm.
We need to chill out, try to be a lot more tolerant and humble. And then maybe we can get along and learn something.
Briefly, Professor Gerald Wing Su, what do you think we should do going forward?
I think that one of the things that I would say immediately is that I'm glad that we're having this dialogue and discussion. I think it's extremely valuable and educational. The second thing is that microaggressions really provides a language for marginalized group members to explain the conflicts and experiences that they're going through, because
and Professor, I'm sorry, Professor, I have to cut you short. I'm sorry, we are out of time for the hour. I wish we had more time to discuss this, but I appreciate you being with us, Professor Gerald Wing Su from Columbia University, Professor Jonathan Haidt from NYU, and Professor Ho-May King of Bryn Mawr College. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Susan Britton, Vinnie Tong, and Suki Lewis. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement editor is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. This is Forum from KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.